Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, March 28th, 2010, and this is show number 252. Well, we've got a fun-filled show this week, so let's just dig right in, shall we? First of all, that little whiner quality control director Steve has checked in after a very long absence. I guess I've just been, you know, flawless for such a long time now, with a little help from the chat room, of course. But he finally caught me on a minor nitpicky little detail. On last week's show, Bart mentioned the update to Safari that took it from version 4.0.4, which was 404, which he really enjoyed for, you know, the geek value, 404 error, that sort of thing, and it changed it to 405. I told him that was easy for me to remember because that's a major freeway here, and he asked me where it goes, and I said it goes from Southern to Northern California. Well, what QA Director Steve so graciously pointed out to me is that the 405 freeway actually stops just north of LA. It's actually the 5 freeway that goes all the way up the state. Thank you so much, QA Director Steve. I'm sure that makes all the difference to the listeners. Really appreciate the help. Well, I'm figuring a good percentage of the folks listening right now are sold on the iPhone / iPod Touch, whether they own one or not. But I think we've become desensitized to exactly how amazing the interface on this tool actually is. We make connections across the globe with a device that we take for granted today. We use it pretty much without thinking about how amazing it is. But this really came back into focus for me when I saw a video on YouTube of a 17-month-old baby using an iPhone. Of course, it's adorable and all that, the baby that is, but that's not actually the point I want to make with this video. In the video, the baby sets it on the table, pushes the home button at the bottom, which turns the phone on. Next, she slides her finger from left to right at the bottom to unlock the phone. She then flips through a few screens to choose the application she wants and very carefully touches the menus in the upper left and upper right of the screen, very, very precisely touching what are visual buttons. Eventually, she succeeds in playing the music she's chosen. Now, I'm not certain this was her intent, but she doesn't seem surprised at all when the music starts. Now, with the music playing, she proceeds to open the photo album. So she has to go back to the home button, and then she goes and opens photos. She scrolls vertically with a flip of her finger to watch the photos go by until she finds the photo she wants. She then touches that photo with her finger, and it comes up full screen. At this point, she does seem quite delighted by this, and she picks up the phone and shows it to the people I can only assume are her parents. She's very careful not to touch the screen as this would undo all of her work finding that photo, which is a mistake I often make. After the delight of the one photo has worn off, she proceeds to flip through the photos one at a time, now flipping sideways, no longer vertically, through the images. Now, I walked you through all of this ahead of time so that when you see the movie, I've embedded it in the show notes, you can think about the interface, not so much about how darn cute the baby is. So the question becomes, is this baby a genius, or are the designers at Apple geniuses because they developed an operating system so intuitive to our human nature that even a 17-month-old baby can learn how to use it? Now, I'm certain this was not her first time playing with it, obviously, but at 17 months old, she had pretty much, I don't know if I'd go mastered it, but she was really, really good at it. I've been thinking about this a great deal right now because I think the touch interface of the iPad is what's going to make it stand out beyond anything we've ever seen before. Anyway, when you get a chance, go over and watch the video in the show notes and you'll see what I mean about how intuitive this interface actually is.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
How do I?
What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Jim Sewell, also known as Deveril on Twitter, sent us in a dumb question. I love this one. Here's what he says. I've been in the Windows world most of my computing life, and with a Win PC, you just plug in a mic and record. It doesn't work that way on the Mac. So I'm told because the Mac doesn't have a preamp built into it, so you need an amplified mic. But here's the weird thing. I have one of the new Mac Minis at work, and on a lark, I plugged my headphones into the microphone jack and talked into them. Felt silly while I did it, but GarageBand was able to record perfectly what I was saying. Of course, the sound quality sounded like I was a moron talking into headphones, but it was perfectly understandable recording. What gives? Well, I think this is a great dumb question because this very week, my buddy Vance asked me the exact same thing, without the iPhone headphone part of the equation. What I told him at the time was that the jack has a that has this headphone symbol on it on the Macs is actually a line level input, not a mic input. Line level inputs require preamplified sound, as Jim said. You can achieve this result by plugging a microphone into something like the Griffin iMic, which does have a preamp, and then you can use that microphone jack. But that doesn't answer why the iPhone headphones worked for Jim. Surely there wasn't a miniature preamp in that little microphone bulge on the headphones, was there? I enlisted the assistance of the smart folks over on LA Pug, a message board of which I'm a member, and Donald Dodge cleared it up for me. Here's what he said. The Mac also can connect to Ring 3 on the Earbud Plus mic headset. The Mac has the preamp that connects to Ring 3. The tip of the plug is the right earbud, the next ring is the left earbud, and the next ring is the mic. The sleeve is ground or common to all three. The confusion may come as the earphone jack is not normally used with a mic. There are many later headsets that have a mic that is connected as above. The use of the third ring is not limited to Apple. You can purchase a wired-on plug from Radio Shack and others and connect a mic to that ring and ground, and the Mac will accept the mic input. Well, I really appreciate the extra help I got there getting this answer, because it was really bugging me why that worked. So now, the mystery is solved. There is a preamp in the Mac, and that third ring on the iPhone headphones can talk to it, but a regular mic cannot unless you use one of those adapter thingies that does have a preamp. Thanks for the question, Jim. It helped me to learn, and Vance was really happy to learn about the why of this, too, because it was bothering him as well.
Hi, this is Alistair from New Zealand, here to tell you about an imminent danger to you all. There's this woman from LA who has discovered a new and addictive drug. Keep it down, I think she may be around. She has been addicted to this drug for a while now, and to feed her habit, she's pushing it on other people too. The drug is made from a rare blue species of the mango fruit and goes by the street name of Screen Steps. The effects of the drug appear to include the inducement of elation, even fun, on certain tasks that should be really frustrating. I myself was sucked into this world of misplaced joy and laughter when the woman offered me a free sample. I thought, what harm can it do? I'm only sampling it. I can give up any time. Let me warn you, friends, it's not easy to give up. Oh no. Before long, you'll be thinking of actually buying this drug, and right there she hooks you again by giving you a discount. And not just a paltry few bucks either, it's a 25% discount. This drug is of the highest quality. The moment you taste it, you'll be in a state of euphoria and you'll constantly seek out reasons to use it. It'll be a new you that everyone sees. They'll see you as a helpful, happy person, eager to tell people how to do stuff for themselves. A far cry from the mean-spirited, frustrated former you. You'll soar to new heights, break your 20-cuss-a-day habit, and the enlightenment will come that you have been the tool, not Word or PowerPoint, and the world will become such a happy place. Oh, heck, here she comes.
My friend Dean has an addiction. He's addicted to buying whatever I tell him to buy. Strangely enough, the live chat room was just talking about the fact that I make people buy things. Hey, it's my fun little thing that I do. Anyway, Dean is definitely addicted. The poor dear has spent an awful lot of money following my fantasy purchases. We got together a few weeks back, and of course I started telling him about how cool the iPad will be. He was already convinced that he did not need it when we started. So then he prompted me to send a series of questions that I think are quite good that clearly show he's going to end up buying it anyway. But I thought I'd go through these questions on the show because I think there's some pretty good questions. And plus I actually knew the answers to most of them. Question 1. The iPad supports JPEG and RAW, so does that mean I can take RAW on the S90 and import them directly into the iPad? I should mention the S90 is the Canon S90 that I talked him into buying while we were also on the trip. I'm sure he's already got it by now. So he wants to know, can he import them directly into the iPad? Well, you'll need to buy the camera adapter, which lets you plug in the SD card, and then the adapter goes into the dock connector. The other option is they'll have an adapter that gives you a USB connector so that you can plug a USB cable in from the camera. That's a little clumsier but more versatile if you're only going to carry one of them for other needs in the future. I believe the two together are considered the camera kit. I'm going to keep an eye on the live chat room and see if anybody corrects me, but I believe you get both of those in what they call the camera kit. Now, some of the stuff isn't going to be available on day one, and I'm trying to remember. I know they talked about the camera kit recently, whether that one was going to be available right away or not. Question two, does it have speakers and a microphone? Yes, it does have a microphone and a built-in speaker. I was able to verify that on Apple's website. Number three, if yes to above, can you attach an external camera to be able to use Skype? Well, I wonder if that would be possible someday. See, there'd have to be drivers for the camera, and you'd have to use that USB adapter that we just talked about. See, it could be more versatile already. I'm betting that right out of the gate, this will not be possible. But maybe it will be someday. In any case, it's not an advertised option. You could, of course, do audio Skype, just not video yet. Question four, can I have the same email accounts on the iPad that I have on my iPhone, .Mac, and work? Yes, absolutely. It's a good idea to set your account set up as IMAP rather than POP. Instead of doing a 45-minute explanation of the two protocols, all you need to know is that if they're set up as IMAP on every device, your iPhone, your iPad, and your Mac, then if you read an email on one device, it shows up as already having been read on the other two. Basically, it keeps them all perfectly in sync. Number five, I assume it will sync with my .Mac account for notes, address book, and a calendar. Is that a good assumption? Yeah, I think that is a good assumption. I haven't seen it explicitly written, but it wouldn't make a bit of sense for them to not support Mobile Me syncing. That functionality is already included in the iPhone OS, and the iPad does run the same OS, or possibly with a few enhancements we haven't gotten to see yet. Number six, will the 3G plan you can buy for the iPad, will it cover international travel? Well, right at the beginning, I don't think you'll be able to use it during international travel. However, since they chose to go with the GSM technology, the one used by AT&T and T-Mobile, and that's the technology that the rest of the world uses, this will eventually work for you in your international travels. See, the iPad isn't going to be ready for the entire world on day one. In fact, it's only going to be available in the U.S., much to the consternation of our international brethren, so you'll have to wait a bit for this to work. The other tricky bit is that Apple chose to use the micro SIM, which is half the size of a standard phone SIM. That means that the international stores where you go to pick up a SIM card will have to carry that micro SIM. Other than that, I think it should work and it should work well. You're future proof to some extent, but you're not present proof. Number seven, if I receive an email with a Microsoft Office attachment, can I see it on the iPad? Yes. The iPad has built-in support to view Microsoft Office attachments, both the older .doc and .xls versions, as well as the new .docx and .xlsx formats. Okay, fine, it can read the same, the PowerPoint versions, the old and the new ones too. When you buy iWork for the iPad, which is $10 each for Pages, Numbers, and Keynote, you'll actually be able to edit Word, Excel, and PowerPoint files right there on the iPad. How's that for cool? Well, Dean, thanks for sending in the questions. I enjoy doing the research to be sure I was giving you good answers, and have fun when you do get your new iPad. I took a quick break to save, and I checked in with the chat room to see what they were up to, and it looks like Mark Dalton had an interesting idea. You remember I've mentioned a few times the BT1 Bluetooth camera for the Mac. It might be possible for them to write an iPhone application that would allow you to use their Bluetooth camera for the iPad. That would be kind of interesting. That's something to keep an eye out for. So thanks, Mark, and appreciate you bringing up that idea. That's a really interesting idea. Well, I know you've heard me rant about this before, but it makes me absolutely crazy when I hear tech podcasters say, oh, this thing's so easy, my mom could use it. I know they mean no harm, and perhaps their mothers are not technically savvy, but it just rubs me like sandpaper every time I hear it. Everybody says it. So many people say this. I have to sit there thinking, so what is it about childbirth that evidently makes women morons? Is that what, I mean, are you really saying that? Do you mean to say that? I'm sure I'm being oversensitive here, but, you know, what message does that give to any young women who might be listening to your show? Or the old fart women like me listening? What does it say? It says we must be simple-minded, right? Well, this week I was talking to a couple of guys, both in their 20s, in their late 20s, and out of the blue, they both said something about the iPad being so easy their mom could use it. these guys are pretty cool, so rather than just blowing a gasket, I decided to ask them about this. I wanted to understand why this would ever come up in the first place. Why would they even think this? Because, I mean, their moms are like my age, right? One of the guys said something really interesting. He said that the deal is that his mom and dad are equally bad at technology, but the difference is that his mom tries to work with tech. His dad basically walks away whenever he brings up something about tech and refuses to even try to learn, but at least his mom is interested enough and trying to make a go of it. That was an intriguing answer. I wonder if anyone else has this experience with their parents. I'm not sure what causes people to say this, but it's like water torture for me. I have this fantasy that I could stop people from saying it. I'm working out some ideas in my mind, like a podcast called So Easy Your Mother Can Do It, where I interview all of the brilliant technical women I know and have them tell their stories of how they ended up in the geek heaven we all enjoy. Not the stories of how hard it was and, you know, they had to fight people, blah, 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 but the stories of how fun it is. I've been noodling this for quite a while, whether I should do some giant roundtable discussions or one-on-one interviews, and then I got to thinking about all the men in podcasting who don't say these silly things. I mean, there's some I listen to that have never said it, and you know I'd be writing notes if they had. Maybe I should interview them and ask them why they don't say it. Anyway, I've been noodling this so long inside my head, I decided it was time to bring it to the outside of my head and ask you what you think. Do you know why people say such a silly thing is so easy my mom could use it? Have you ever heard yourself say it? Is there something about childbirth that makes women incapable of understanding technology? Remember the time Bart did it? Hey, he's still hurting from that one. Well, what do you think about this? Make me some audio recordings and tell me what you think. I really want to know what's going on here. Well, Matt is back with a review of RemotePad, which is an iPhone and iPod Touch remote control app from Tengen.org.
Hi, Allison. This is Matt Rinesmith again with another review of another iPhone. Today, I'm reviewing an app called RemotePad. What this app does is it emulates a keyboard and mouse, so you can control your laptop, desktop, any type of computer you can think of, from your iPhone or iPod Touch. Now, its server runs on Windows, Linux, and Mac, so all you have to do is, in the case of Linux, you do have to compile it from source, but other than that, it's very simple and easy to install as well. On the Mac, you simply download a DMG file and drag the server to your applications folder, run it, and ta-da! Anyway, let's get to the review of the actual app. Now, when you launch it from your Springboard, you're presented with a simple screen which gives you the name of your iPhone or iPod, a box to enter the IP address or host name of the server you're connecting to, and a list of servers that it can detect through Bonjour, aka ZeroConf, technology. Now, if you're connecting to a Mac, it's almost guaranteed that you'll just show up in the list and you don't have to worry about an IP address. However, if you're connecting to Windows or Linux, I believe you'll have to know your computer's IP address to connect. Once you're connected, you're presented with a very simple connected screen with a continue button. Once you press continue, you're given a black screen with the buttons along the top and a bar along the bottom that says hide button, show keyboard, and setup. If you tap setup, you can disconnect the session, change the number of buttons, whether or not the left or right button is the primary button, and whether or not to display the button labels. Under scrolling options, you can decide whether to use two fingers to scroll. I think any MacBook Pro users with one of the new multi-touch trackpads would love to have this on. Whether or not you can do horizontal scrolling, and whether or not it supports center button scrolling, which means holding the center button while using your other hand to scroll. You can change your scrolling speed. You can also change your tracking speed, and whether or not you click by tapping. And then you can change whether or not you can drag using drag lock. This allows you to double tap something, move your finger, and then tap again to basically execute a drag as though you were holding the button down the whole time. Also, you can turn on secondary clicking, which allows you to tap with two fingers to right click, or if you're left-handed, to left click. You can change how you toggle the status bar, as in whether you single click, triple click, or just don't toggle it at all. You can also do a click and drag to input an arrow key. I don't really like this, so I've turned it off. And here's a big feature. There is an accelerometer function. What this does is, when you hold down your finger on the trackpad, you can wave it around, and your mouse will actually follow the path of your iPhone and iPod Touch. It's not perfect, but I think it works very well. And I think in the 3GS, it actually interfaces the compass as well. There's also the ability to keep it from rotating, very good if you're using the accelerometer function. And you can prohibit your iPhone or iPod Touch from going into sleep mode. So, how does it work? It works very well, in fact. I have not had any kind of problems. The only problems I've had was when my computer was under a serious load. As in, like, maybe trying to play 3 or 4 Flash videos at once. Then the cursor would lag behind a little bit. However, the keyboard function, while it does tell you that it's not encrypted, so if you're sending something over an unlocked Wi-Fi network, be careful because it could be sniffed. It's great for something like, say, IMing or Skype chat, etc. And I think it works very well. It supports portrait and landscape, and, you know, really, it doesn't do much else than that. It's not very pretty, but it gets the job done, and it's not ugly. So, thanks for listening, and bye!
Thanks, Matt. You find the most interesting things to review. Now, you do stretch my brain a little bit. Did you actually say I have to compile this code to get it to work? Yikes! Well, you've gotten me to do an awful lot of scary things in Linux so far, so who knows? It could happen. Anyway, Matt has done a really nice text review over on iampodcast.tv, complete with screenshots so you can see what he's talking about. When I look at cars on the road, I see them in two categories. Cars that Honda Bob would take care of, and those that he won't. This is important because I simply can't let myself lust after a car that I can never buy. Now, you might think I'm simple-minded, but it makes no sense for me to admire a sexy Camaro beyond pure fantasy because I simply would never buy a car that Honda Bob wouldn't maintain for me. After over 30 years with a mechanic who does reliable work, he's fast and efficient, and he drives to my house and does the work while I relax inside, or sometimes I come outside and pester him, how could I even consider another type of car, no matter how sexy? Luckily, Hondas and Acuras are incredibly reliable cars, and some of the models are reasonably sexy, so this hasn't ever been an issue for me. If you're not this crazy loyal to your mechanic, and you live in the LA or Orange County areas, maybe you should consider a Honda or an Acura for your next vehicle. Heck, Honda Bob will even help you check out a potential used Honda or Acura before you buy. Give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hjbob@aol.com. HJ Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. What's that time of the week again? It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. How is Ireland today, Bart?
Ireland is sunny and dry and
what?
Not cold.
What?
I wouldn't go so far as to say warm now.
Are you sure you're talking about Ireland?
Let me look out the window. There's this funny yellow thing in the sky, and the sky kind of this funny blue color. What does that mean?
We have that here pretty often, actually. Interesting. Well, hey, you have something to plug here before we get started.
Yes, as many people may or may not know, as well as appearing here and enjoying myself here very much, I also do another podcast with a guy called Stu Helm and a large team of many great people called the International Mac Podcast at iampodcast.tv. And we celebrate our 100th show this weekend.
Woohoo! That's hard to believe. Now is that's because you did 12 in one day, right? That sped it up.
No, they don't count.
Really?
We're not counting 12 cubes as part of our.
Wow.
So yeah, cause our show number is counted. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Then you know, 12 cubed, and then we just continued on after that. So we didn't actually count 12 cubed at all.
Wow! It's hard to believe it's been going that long. That's amazing.
Yeah, so we were. It kind of snuck up on us a bit, but we still got a really good special guest on for the show. It's quite a long show. You have a new record to try beat, Alice.
Oh no! I thought at 1:40 last week, I was doing pretty good.
Well, that's our average time, but this one went above average because we had a bunch of giveaways to do live in the show, which turned out to be a lot more difficult than you think.
Oh, right.
Because we thought we had a bot written for IRC that would randomly pick a person, but then it fell in a heap the first time we tried to use it. So I used random.org to pick people.
Oh.
And I kept on picking the panel.
Oh, no.
Randomly.
What was the panel doing in the list?
Well, it's just where I was just, you know, basically I had everyone who's in the IRC stream at that minute ordered alphabetically and then picking a number from random.org between one and the number of people in the room.
Oh, okay, I got it.
And then just counted down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, whatever. And they kept on landing on people who I wasn't supposed to land on. It was funny.
Were you doing that live?
Yeah, well, we did half of our giveaways live and half we're doing over email. So if you listen to the episode, there is a whole bunch of stuff going. Off the top of my head, I know there's a copy of 1Password going. I'm pretty sure we have another copy of Texas Commander 3 going. We have a really good prize, the entirety of the Topaz bundle going. Which is, yeah, that's a big one.
Yeah.
We have some stuff from Smile on My Mac as well. I can't remember which we gave away live and which we have left over, but Smile on My Mac are very good to us. And we also have a whole bunch of coupon codes to get everyone 15 and 20% off different products.
Oh, fantastic. So you're celebrating your birthday by giving away things to other people.
Yeah, seems like a good thing to do. And having a really cool special guest on, which I can say now because our special guest announced it on his own show. So it's Ken Ray from macOS Ken as our special guest.
Oh, hot dogs. That's fantastic.
Yeah, he rocked.
He's a good guy. All right, yeah, cool. Anything else on that?
Well, it's just, as I say, it's just our regular show, which is, I guess, Mac news from an international point of view, which is really what we do. We try to set ourselves apart by giving it that international point of view. And we try not to just list news. We try to talk about the news instead of just saying what happened, but also have a bit of discussion.
Right, right. And definitely a lot of hosts and a lot of variability to who the hosts are from time to time. So it's a nice mix up.
I guess in some ways we're a bit like the Mac Roundtable, where we try to have a really broad panel that we dip into, and so it's always changing up.
Right, right. Well, fantastic. That's congratulations on that, and congratulations, Stu. That's quite an achievement for both of you guys to and the entire panel to pull that off. It takes a lot of energy to keep it going, doesn't it?
It does take a lot of energy to do it every week, but I have to say Stu deserves more credit than I do because Stu really, really puts his heart and soul into the podcast.
Yeah, yeah, but without you, you control them and keep it down to an hour and 40 minutes, right?
my old line was we should try to be under an hour, but I've given up, and I say we strive to be under an hour and a half.
I used to go to a staff meeting where it was always an hour and a half, and I told them that if they could get it under an hour, I'd bake cookies. So they did it once, and I baked them cookies. They never did it again. I don't know if it was my cookies weren't good enough, what the deal was.
I was just going to say, maybe they didn't like your cookies.
I know, it's so sad.
To be honest, though, if you were my boss and I knew I was getting cookies for being brief, I'd be very brief.
Well, it was actually my boss. I was trying to get him to be brief.
I don't have anyone under me. But if I did have underlings and they baked me cookies, I'd be brief.
All right. Well, hey, let's eat our vegetables now. What do we got up on Security Light?
We have a rather Mozilla-centric Security Light, and it's sort of half good news, half bad news.
Uh-oh.
And even the bad news is kind of half good news. So I guess it's one third bad news and two thirds good news.
Oh, math is hard.
Yeah, that doesn't even work. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The week started with the German government. You may remember a couple of months ago now, they issued a warning to Germans not to use Internet Explorer because it was too dangerous.
Right, and that's when the downloads of Opera went doubled because of that.
Yes. Huh? Well, this time they issued another warning to Firefox 3.6 users.
Uh-oh.
Because there was a very serious flaw in Firefox 3.6 for Windows, and it's a Windows-only flaw.
Hmm.
And it was basically remote code execution. It was very bad. So they issued a warning to say, you know, do not use 3.6 until Mozilla update and fix this flaw. And it was within the same day that it arrived in my newsreader, but there can't have been much time between them in the real world either. Very shortly afterwards, Mozilla released Firefox 3.6.2, which addresses that vulnerability, so that problem is now gone.
Wow, so that was fast.
Wonderfully fast. Such a lovely, pleasant change from a lot of the stuff we tend to talk about.
It's interesting that the German government has actually gotten itself into this business.
Well, it's their version of US CERT.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay, I got you.
So it's sort of German cert. I don't know the exact German pronunciation of these things, but it's a government organization whose responsibility is to... It's a computer emergency response team is what a cert is.
Mm-hmm.
So the US government run a cert that's considered sort of a... It's a really good standard. I have it on my RSS reader, even though I'm not American, because if US cert give a warning about it, it's something to actually bear in mind. Okay. So a lot of security light comes from US cert. Well, the Germans have their own cert, and that's where this warning came from.
I got you. All right. So if you're running Windows, make sure Firefox... Usually Firefox, once you get to 3.5, I think, it just does all those updates on its own, right?
It does. 3.5 is not affected, actually. It's literally only 3.6.
Okay, that's right, because 3.5 didn't automatically go to 3.6. Is that correct?
It started to. Not automatically.
Okay.
It started to nag. About 2 weeks ago, I think it started to nag, or maybe even just a week ago, which is actually somewhat ironic, because it means they were nagging you to upgrade from a safe to an unsafe version for a couple of days.
Well, maybe they didn't know it was unsafe yet. One would assume.
The flaw was out, and I was still being nagged.
Oh, jeez.
But I presume it was automated in some way, the nagging.
Sure. Yeah, you would think.
I haven't done the upgrade because one of my plugins doesn't work on 3.6.
Oh, I see. But yeah, so the mine's updated to 3.6 too. But whenever it says to update, I just go, okay.
Yeah.
I'd rather live without a plugin than have a vulnerable.
Well, in my case, it's not a vulnerable. So I'm on 3.5, which is safe. And it wants me to go to 3.6, which is now safe. But I'm not going because I am... It's the plugin I use for mouse gestures.
Oh.
And so basically I hold down the right button and I make a gesture and it sends commands like back or refresh or whatever. And I use that a lot.
Oh, okay. See, the difference is in your case, you actually know that 3.5 is safe since I choose not to be educated anything beyond what you tell me. I choose that, right? I understand that's my choice to not pay attention. Sure. My answer is if it says to update, I update. Because I figure 95% of the time it's probably a security update and I better do as I'm told.
That is true. The release notes, they'll always give you a release notes for any version of Firefox. And they're actually very good about splitting it out into security stuff and non-security stuff. In fact, they tend to split it into bug fixes, enhancements, and security fixes.
Okay.
So then you can, and so some updates won't have any security fixes. They'll only have enhancements and bug fixes. But to be honest, they are, like you say, quite rare.
Yeah, and that would require me to read or something when it came out, so that ain't going to happen.
Sure, the path of least resistance is most certainly to upgrade, and that's, let's face it, the safest thing to do.
Right, right. Okay, let's see, there's another one in there.
So that was the half bad, half good news. So now we have the good news. A feature that's a standard part of Firefox 3.6 is a check of your plugins so that you're not being hacked through your Flash plugin. So it checks that your plugins are at the latest version. And that is built into 3.6. There's also a web page version of it that works on older versions of Firefox. It's just literally just a website you go to, and the link is in the show notes. And it scans through all of your plugins. It's called Plugin Check. And it just tells you, you need to update this, this is fine, this is fine, you need to update this. Or maybe delete this. I mean, whatever. But just list your plugins and their status. That only works on Firefox for the moment, but what they've announced is they're going to add support for Internet Explorer into this web page so that Internet Explorer users can actually go to this Mozilla website and figure out whether their plugins are up to date or not.
Really?
Yep.
But that would presume that you had plugins on IE and Chrome, and I guess we can't on Chrome now.
No, these aren't browser add-ons, these are plugins. In the old-fashioned meaning of the word.
Okay, the website you sent to says outdated vulnerable add-ons. It calls them add-ons. What's an add-on versus a plugin?
It depends on who you ask. Mozilla have changed the terminology in this.
Right.
Add-on to them is an overarching thing. So an add-on to Mozilla is either a web plugin, a Firefox plugin, or a theme.
Right.
So they're all add-ons because there's little extra things you plug in.
Right.
So the important bit is the traditional web plugin, i.e. your Flash, your Windows Media Player, whatever other traditional plugins. They're the ones that are the real security flaw. And so they're the interesting bit of this, and that's the bit that's being handed on, that they're going to support IE on.
Huh.
And I think Safari as well. So basically, it's a service to the internet.
So what the link you put in the show notes actually takes you to a Macworld article about it. It's not actually up yet, right?
It's not up yet. Well, it is and it isn't. If you read to the Macworld article, it's up on a staging server at the moment. So it's up for basically a beta version. Mm-hmm. And so they have a link in the Macworld article to where it will be for real, which is where you can already go today to check your Firefox plugins. And there's also a link further down the article to the sort of proof of concept, which is at a temporary URL for testing.
Hmm. So maybe you'll let us know when this goes for real?
If assuming it makes the news again, yes.
Right, right. Interesting.
It's very altruistic of them. I read it and I was very pleased.
Huh. Now I'm sitting here, of course, I'm distracted because I'm over there looking to see if my plugins are up to date. Okay, so
well, you're running 3.6, though, so you're fine.
I'm running 3.6.2, Bart, not 3.6.
You're even finer, yes. Well, that's part of the 3.6 branch. Anyway, right. So you get that functionality without having to visit a web page. For you, that's an inbuilt part of your browser, and it will actually pop up warnings when your flash goes out of date without you having to visit anything.
Okay, but other browsers don't do that?
Other browsers don't do that, and other versions of Firefox don't do that. So 3.5, 3.0, they won't do that.
Hmm.
But they can go to this webpage already, and then other browsers can go to it later.
Oh, that's pretty cool. You know, it's showing a whole bunch of plugins I didn't know I even had. iPhoto Photocast from iPhoto 6? I've never even heard of that. And it says it's unable to detect the plugin version. It says I've got a Facebook plugin, a Movie Network's Quantum Media Player.
It's showing all the plugins it's testing for rather than all the plugins. So if it can't detect it, it may be because it's not there.
Oh, well, it says unable to detect plugin version. A Facebook plugin, that sounds like something I would have done. Cool Iris embedded in Tab, and I do have Cool Iris as an extension.
Okay, because that doesn't come up for me, so I guess it is picking you out on a per plugin basis. So it doesn't know everything.
But it knows more than I do.
Yes, and the really important stuff like Flash it most certainly knows about, which is good.
Yeah.
Because that's the one that's likely to get you into trouble. I mean, realistically, it's one of the most popular ways to get hacked these days is Flash.
Now, I'm not sure, though, that... See, Flash... That's interesting. Okay, so we were just saying that Firefox tells you on its own whether you've got problems that things aren't up to date. But remember I was having that problem with my system freezing up during the live show? I ended up fixing that by going to the Flash website and downloading an update. So it was not telling me that Flash was out of date.
But what version of Firefox would be on that machine? Would it be 3.5 or 3.6?
It's this same machine I'm on right now, and it wasn't that long ago. It was maybe... How long ago did 3.6 come out?
Well, 3.6 wouldn't have asked you to upgrade to it until quite recently.
To 3.6?
Yeah, it wouldn't have been an automatic thing. You wouldn't have automatically got there until quite recently.
Hmm.
So a couple of months ago, it's quite realistic that you were on 3.5.
Okay. It could have been. Oh, look at that. Plugins. Man, I got a lot of plugins. What is all this crap? I should disable some of this.
It's no harm, actually, just to go through your plugins purely from a speed point of view.
Right, right. Look at all this junk. Flip for Mac Windows Media Player plugin. I might need that. I don't even know what the heck is iPhoto Photocast? Never heard of that.
Neither have I.
Java embedding plugin. I probably want that one. Move Networks yes. Quantum Media Player. Come on. I didn't put that in there. All right. Sorry. Derailing the show entirely. Interesting thing. I had not... it had bothered me that they had changed it from plugins to add-ons, and I was wondering what that meant. But you're right. There's a nice little... If you go to add-ons, you have extensions, themes, and plugins. So extensions are the things like Flash Block and that sort of stuff, and then themes are if you want it to look neato.
Mm-hmm.
Which is always fun.
Plugins are the traditional thing that every browser has.
Yeah. Okay.
Goodness gracious, I have Shockwave Director in here. Shockwave. Log me in plugin.
Ooh.
And I have iPhoto Photocast 7.0 as well.
I don't anymore.
Nuki, nuki.
It's gone. All right, well, that's pretty interesting. I hope they... that's kind of interesting that Mozilla is doing that for the good of the internet, like you say.
Yeah, it's purely altruistic, but of course as an open source project, they have no responsibility to make money. They're purely a charitable foundation, so they can do that kind of thing.
Kind of neat. All right. So, taking a full, 90-degree turn to a completely different subject, what's our main topic, Bart?
Well, we're not going to get to our main topic just yet. We're now security heavy.
That's our medium topic, right?
Yeah, I really wanted to, well, you mentioned this as well, and I wanted to talk about it too, but it certainly does not fit security light. So I called it security heavy. But basically, there's a very major security conference happens once a year about this time of the year called CANSEC West. And as part of CANSEC West, they do a competition called the Pwn to Own competition, which has become really quite famous since it was started 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, Pwn is a hacker slang word for own, which is a hacker slang word for hack or take over. So if you own something, you've taken it over.
And Pwn is spelled P-W-N.
P-0. It depends how, yeah, there's many different ways of spelling Pwn.
Yeah, you threw all kinds of extra characters in that name.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's leash, so you're kind of free to invent as long as it's clear what you mean.
And when Bart says leet, he means L33T, and that's a whole other subject. So.
Or 1337, depending. See, even leet can be spelled in many different ways.
Okay, so again, back to where CANSEC West, and they have the Pwn to Own contest.
So the theory is they have shiny goodies. It started off with the MacBook Air. It was the first time it was done. But they have shiny goodies sitting there, and if you hack them, you get to keep the shiny goodies and you get a prize of either 10,000 or 15,000, depending on which thing you hack.
Okay.
So that's pretty decent, and it tends to attract some pretty talented people. Probably the all-time rock star of the Pwn to Own contest is a guy called Charlie Miller, who is a very good researcher who has focused very heavily on Mac products over the last couple of years. He's very often not very complimentary of Apple, but the guy really knows his stuff. And anytime he says something bad about Apple, he can back it up with 20 squillion facts to prove it as well.
Hmm.
I mean, no one likes what he has to say, but no one can argue that it's the truth. I guess it's slightly annoying.
I think he first got the MacBook Air, it looks like March of 2008.
Yes, this is now his third win. So 2008 would be his first, 2009 would be his second, and 2010 would be his third.
Right, right.
And the 2008 was the first competition, I believe. So I think he's always won it, basically.
So what's good about this, though, is it wipes the snotty little smirk off the Apple fanboy faces like ours that we think we're more, you know, we're all secure and we don't use Windows and nothing bad can ever happen to us, because he just goes, oh, yeah, here. Boom.
Yeah, the really important point here is that Pwn to Own is always done on fully patched systems.
Right. They're not touching the system either. They don't physically touch. Right. So it's not like they get on the machine and they can load something to it from physically touching the machine.
Yeah, so there's a few phases in the competition, but one of the phases is you're allowed to send an email and get people to interact that way. So it's not always, does sometimes involve some user interaction, but you never get onto the machine. Right. So it's send an email and someone clicks the link and then the machine is hacked. That's acceptable at later stages of the competition.
Okay.
And to be honest, that's pretty much always how it's won, because the weakest way into pretty much any machine these days is through its web browser. And I should say, this is not a Mac-only thing.
Oh, you're right. It's just, it's getting more attention because it's not just the, you know, daily Adobe crack of the week or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, Windows 7 running IE8 fully patched was also owned.
Right.
Windows 7 running Firefox fully patched was also owned.
Right.
I think one that wasn't, last I heard, hacked yet was Google's browser, Chrome. Oh. But as far as I understand, that was because no one had tried to.
So, okay, yeah.
So it's very hard for it to be hacked if no hacker actually gave it a go.
Right.
So the biggest take-home from Pwn to Own isn't that, oh my god, there's a way to hack into the Mac. It's, well, actually, there is nothing completely safe out there. Get over that notion.
Right.
So some particularly interesting points. One is that the iPhone didn't fall last year, but it did fall this year.
Hmm.
Which is actually, to be honest, quite a surprise, because with iPhone 2.0, Apple really, really made it difficult to exploit that phone. They put in sandboxing and a whole bunch of really nice security features like digital code signing that makes it exceptionally difficult to be hacked. So difficult that it wasn't done last year. But this year, through Mobile Safari, it was successfully hacked.
Hmm. Okay.
Which is significant because it just hasn't happened in a long time. The iPhone actually has done very well, but it did fall this year. The other thing that's significant is Charlie Miller's attitude.
Okay.
I support him on this, but goodness, is he going to make himself unpopular.
What did he do?
Well, okay, so before we describe what he's done differently, let's start by looking at the norm or the status quo. So the way these things have always gone is that software vendor releases software, security researchers poke away at it, find flaws with it, tell the vendor what the flaw was, and then in theory the vendor fixes it. Now there's often a bit of a diversion there, where a hacker finds problem, tells software vendor, then there was a brief phase where software vendor would sue hacker. That was a bad idea, and that doesn't seem to happen as much these days.
Yeah, that really stopped him from doing it, too.
That was the most ridiculous thing on the planet, because if the good guys are finding this stuff, the bad guys are too.
Right.
So suing the good guys doesn't achieve anything other than basically making the whole world less secure. It was this notion of, we can't have people know that there's flaws in our software, because that's bad for our image, so we're going to sue you for saying bad things about us. Thankfully, that phase is over. Or mostly over anyway. The other thing that would happen quite often is that a hacker would tell company that there's a problem. Company would do nothing for 6 months, so a hacker eventually gets annoyed and goes public. And then all of a sudden there's a big panic, and oh my god, we must rush out a patch, and how dare he go public with this disclosure before we've had time to fix it. And he's like going, yeah, well, I told you a year ago. I mean, come on. So anyway, that's sort of the basic way that these things have gone. What Charlie Miller would like to see happen is that Apple and Microsoft and Cisco and every other big company out there do the kind of research that Charlie Miller does before releasing the products. Because Charlie Miller is just an ordinary guy. He doesn't get at Apple software before it goes public. He starts his research the moment it's released to the general public. And he finds loads of bugs. The big paper he presented was basically where he said, I have 30 bugs in OS X, 20 of which are in preview. I've used one to win Pwn to Own. There's 19 more.
Right.
And I'm not going to give these 30 bugs to Apple, but I am offering to teach Apple to do what I do.
And he's one guy.
He's one guy.
In theory, you would think Apple might have more than one guy.
In theory, Apple should have a lot more than one guy.
That they could apply to this issue, right, if they chose to.
Yes. Now, what Charlie Miller is using is a technique called fuzzing,
okay,
which is actually an automated technique. So he basically has some scripts, and he says there are 5 lines of Python code, which is really very little.
Yeah.
Although Python is quite a powerful language. So yeah, you can do a lot in 5 lines of Python, but nonetheless, it's still only 5 lines of code. And the idea of fuzzing is you basically throw random data at the app and see how it handles it, because most flaws are buffer overflows and things where the program does what you expect it to do as long as you give it the data it expects to get, but it fails to do appropriate error checking in certain conditions, and that's what causes the crash. And a crash tends to lead to the possibility of arbitrary code execution. So what a fuzzer does is it just throws dirty data at the app. It automatically generates random bogus data and fires it at the app. And when the app falls over and dies, then you rewind from there and see what part of it was executing at the time. Ah, okay, I found this flaw, and I can now trigger it reliably by sending this data in this way. And then you have yourself a vulnerability. Now, Apple should be doing fuzzing themselves. And Charlie Miller says they probably are doing basic fuzzing, but they're obviously not very good at it. Because if they were, they'd be finding this stuff before it ever got to him.
Now, that assumes that it's reasonably easy to fix those things that he's finding too, though, doesn't it?
Oh, sure. These things are usually very straightforward. I mean, most of the world's software is still written in some version of C. And C is a pretty low-level language that expects you to do an awful lot of simple error checking, where you're writing your program expecting something to be a certain length, and if you don't explicitly check that it really is that length and just execute your code assuming that it is instead of checking that it is, then you can get buffer overruns and all these kind of problems we're used to. So usually they're actually very trivial errors, but they're somewhere amidst a few million lines of code.
Okay.
So if you use a fuzzer and the fuzzer trips up at a certain point in the program where you know, at that point we were doing X. So we look at the code for X and we suddenly see, oh, would you look at that? We forgot to do a bounds check here. Or, you know, we just need to tweak this or add in this little check or add in an extra parameter to make sure something is safe. They're usually quite simple fixes, the kind of stuff you uncover from fuzzing.
Okay,
fuzzing isn't looking for logic problems.
Okay.
It's just using dirty data. So you could argue that fuzzing is just a first step in a good security process. But Charlie Miller says, clearly, He doesn't say they're not fuzzing. He just says they're not fuzzing well, and he's offered to teach them how to fuzz properly rather than just handing them over the 30 vulnerabilities.
I think that's a really interesting idea. But now, between you, me, and the fence post and everyone listening, what do you think the chances are that Apple's actually going to take them up on this?
Well, what I said on IMP Live was that I'd eat my hat if he ever, was ever invited over to Cupertino for a demo.
Is it... They're not... Well, okay. But what they might do is just learn from what he has said so far, right?
Well, I mean, yeah, they could. I mean, he writes journal papers and stuff. He publishes information. So I guess they could go and learn by themselves. They don't have to actually ask him over for tea to learn from him.
Right. It's too bad they aren't. I mean...
I think they should, and I think it would speak volumes. It's really the teach a man to fish rather than give a man a fish technique.
Sure. Yeah.
And I'm all in favor, but I can guarantee you he's going to get bad-mouthed at something serious.
Right. But you think it's a reasonable approach he's taking?
I really think it is, because he's right. The status quo sucks. We should try to do something about it.
Right. But no, it's also certainly in his best interests financially to do this, that if they were to accept it, which, you know, what, like you said, the hat eating and all
that's not quite true. It's not quite true that it's in his best interest to accept it. Because if he
financially,
was out to make...
I mean, he could make money.
No. If he was out to make money, he wouldn't even be telling anyone he had these apart from the Russian mafia. Each of those 20 vulnerabilities is worth millions to the right people.
Okay.
If he was out for money, he wouldn't be standing up at CanSec West talking about it.
Okay.
He'd be out dealing with the seedy underbelly of the internet and getting paid an awful lot of money for each one.
I guess so.
Yeah, no, it's true. And there's also reputable companies that buy vulnerabilities on behalf of basically us, the world. Tipping Point would be an example of one of these organizations. They take donations from corporations and then use that money to buy vulnerabilities off people,
right,
so that the researchers get paid not just by the Russian mafia and other underground organizations, but also by the good guys.
Right, right.
That's controversial, too. But Charlie Miller isn't in that business.
That's good.
You know, you don't stand there.
So that's part of why you respect him, right?
It is why I respect him, because he genuinely does seem to have the interests of the Mac platform, you know, at heart when he's doing these kind of things.
Okay.
And he, you know, Apple... I mean, we're safer on the Mac, but we're not more secure.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I was looking for a source on this,
safer,
but I heard someone...
Yeah, elaborate on that.
I heard someone say that Charlie Miller said... So I really wish I'd found the source, but obviously this was an interview or something. But he used the analogy of two different houses, one of which could be out in the middle of the prairie somewhere where the nearest neighbor is 5 miles away, and they have fairly poor locks on the door, but they're actually quite safe no matter how poor the lock is. You have a similar house in the middle of a not-so-good part of a large city. You could have massive bars in all the windows, and you're still less safe than your much poorer protected house in the middle of the prairie somewhere.
I get you. Okay.
So he's saying that Mac is the house, little house on the prairie, and Windows is the house with all the bars and doors and all the bars and all the doors and stuff in the middle of a bad neighborhood, and it's still actually less safe, even though it is actually more secure.
Okay, I got you. Oh, that's a good analogy.
So, because people get very confused, because the actual reality, whether we like it or not, is that Windows is more secure than Mac these days. Shocking.
Because of the speed with which they fix vulnerabilities, not the speed with which they come out with vulnerabilities?
No, it's because the technology is in the OS to make vulnerabilities harder to exploit.
Hmm.
They have better address space layout randomization. They have better data execution protection. They're further along the process of implementing obstructions to exploitation. So the idea is, if you accept the reality that no code is perfect because it's all written by humans, therefore you have to assume that there are going to be vulnerabilities in software. So you should design your operating system knowing that there are vulnerabilities and design it in such a way to make it really hard for those vulnerabilities to allow you to actually do anything. And that's where address space layout randomization, all of these modern techniques come in. Hmm. And Windows is ahead of the Mac on implementing these things.
I guess one thing that would make me... question that, not that anything you said isn't true, but there's... the fact that there's so many things that are not built into the Windows operating system forces you to install other stuff that is not secure. For example, having Preview on the Mac, even though obviously there are at least 20 vulnerabilities in Preview, there are known vulnerabilities and exploited vulnerabilities in Adobe products that are killing them. And it's not because Microsoft has created a poor operating system. Well, actually, they should have built in a Preview functionality. But, you know, people are forced to use Adobe products in order to view simple PDFs, and that hurts them, I think.
The argument has been made for a long time, and this week sort of adds more weight to that argument, that Preview is probably every bit as vulnerable as Adobe is, but
it's safer.
Adobe is what the attackers are focusing on because
sure.
It is ubiquitous.
Sure.
And therefore, it's a much better attack surface. I mean, those 20 Preview vulnerabilities don't surprise me. The actual problem that Adobe have, now they're kind of, Apple are kind of the victims of this, but Adobe are kind of the cause. The PDF spec is useless. It is so complicated. There is so much self-executing code and bizarreness in the PDF spec that I actually think it's probably impossible to make a secure PDF reader because of how badly designed PDF is.
Wow.
Now, Apple can't change that. They just have to do their best. Adobe are stuck with this reality, but it is a reality of their own creation.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel less sorry for them. But I don't know. I don't think that's particularly... I think that's another example of just Preview is the house on the prairie, because I don't actually think it's any safer than Adobe's products.
Okay.
Anyway, so...
Okay. So, that was interesting. I mean, and it does kind of fit our theme, I think, still. It is, we have to give it security heavy, but that was really interesting. I really wanted to know what had come out of that. Because a lot of people read a message board where people were like, oh, this guy's just full of it. He doesn't really know anything. There's no way there's all those vulnerabilities. I'm like, yeah, and he's proved it.
I was just going to say, you could say that about someone you'd never heard of before, some random name, but goodness gracious, Charlie Miller has years and years of experience with this stuff. The guy has proved himself over and over again. To pretend that he is not the expert that he is really sticking your head in the sand. It's just ostrich carry on.
Yeah, I think the problem was that there was an email that went out shortly before CanSec West that said that that this guy was going to show 30 bugs and he was going to show it at CanSec West and he was going to ruin the Mac. And it was written very, very inflammatory. So if you didn't know anything about security, I would have looked at it too and just said, this is crap, you know, because people love to write those articles and not have anything behind
sure.
it. So they didn't know what they were talking about, but I corrected them. So anyway, I'm going to tell them to listen to this so they can hear more about it if they're interested.
Yeah, Charlie Miller tends not to use those inflammatory words himself. He tends to just make the case in rationed, logical argument.
Yeah.
And then the press like to sell newspaper / blog posts to get you to click on stuff. So they like to spice up what he says.
Yeah, that's what it smelled like.
Yeah. Link bait, I believe, is the phrase.
Exactly. Well, we actually have a non-security topic this week, too, don't we?
I thought, after all of that heavy stuff, it would be nice to go for a light and happy story as well.
Wait, okay, so we had our vegetables, you know, and we took some vitamins, and now we get to play.
Yes, now we have ice cream.
By the way, I have loaded this and played with it, so I get to play
it's
too.
It's fun, isn't it?
Oh, it's way fun.
Yes. So we need to give some credit here. The first credit goes to Tim Verporten, whose fabulous Mac Review cast put me onto this program.
That's where I heard it too.
I mean, Tim is just great because if you don't subscribe to the Mac Review Cast, you really should. He does an advanced podcast feed, so all the links are there straight while you're watching the podcast or listening to the podcast. You can just click on them and go straight to the program. But he just goes through all the latest cool new freeware stuff every week. And if there's one source of all the coolest new products, you know.
aggregator.
Exactly. He's a human aggregator applying some intelligence to it. And I listen to him every week. Every week he's on. Yes. There's weeks go by where there's nothing that interests me personally because, you know, there's great programs, but they don't overlap with my needs. But guaranteed a few times a month, something really cool will come up and I'll discover it on Tim's show.
We should put a link to his show.
We really should. Then the second bit of credit goes to the Mac Roundtable, who someone, I think it was Steve Stanger, but I could be wrong, someone on the Mac Roundtable picked this as their pick on one of our recent episodes.
Ah, okay. I didn't remember that.
I'm not sure you were on that show, but Tim was on the show. So.
I wonder whether it was the one they did together on Steve Stanger's show, because Steve on the...
I was on it, so...
Oh, okay.
I haven't been on Steve's show.
Because Steve and Tim did two shows that were just fantastic on Steve's show, where they did all their favorite freeware and shareware picks, and it was a two episodes worth, and it's just a bundle of joy. That's the Mac Attack is the name of that podcast.
The Mac Attack is great. And
if we could plug everything.
Now that I think about it, it may have been John F. Braun who picked it.
Okay.
Because he's a budding photographer, too.
But all this tease, we haven't told him what it is yet.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, so we have talked on this show many times about HDR, and it's always involved forking over some cash. And it's always involved sort of diving in at the deep end, because any of the programs we've mentioned all have lots of different sliders and knobs and buttons and things, and involve a fair bit of skill to get a useful output from.
Now, just in case somebody's just coming in new, briefly, what is HDR?
Okay, HDR just means high dynamic range. So it just means images that have a lot of information between the very brightest bright and the very darkest dark within the photo. Normally with a JPEG, there's 8 bits of data between black and white, which is not a lot, and it's less than the human eye sees. So if you go out on a very sunny day with very dark shadows and you take pictures, they won't look right. You know, you'll look at the shadow with your human eye and you'll see detail in that shadow.
Right.
And you'll get your photograph out of your camera and the shadows will be just pitch black with all the detail gone. Or you'll take a picture with very bright clouds and your eye can see them as nice, shiny, fluffy clouds. But because there isn't enough room for all that data in the JPEG, they'll just be solid white instead of nice, fluffy clouds. And you'll be, where's all that detail gone?
Right, right.
So a JPEG will just throw that detail away. So true HDR involves somehow getting more information and storing it. So one way to do that is to use RAW instead of JPEG, and the RAW simply contains more data. Another way is to take lots of JPEGs, stack them together, and then so you take one JPEG at normal exposure, one that's overexposed, and one that's underexposed, and then between those three you have all the data. You have the bright bits, the dark bits, and the middle bits.
Okay.
Combine them together, and you have everything.
Now, with this, you can make really goofy, weird-looking photos, but you can also make some that are just really intriguing, and then some that just reflect more like what the eye would actually have seen, right?
Okay, well, you're jumping slightly ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So that's the HDR bit. So getting a file that contains the information is the HDR bit. However, having a file that contains the information is not the same as making it possible to display that information. So tone mapping is the process of taking all of that information and intelligently compressing it into a JPEG again. And so the JPEG still can only hold 8 bits of data, but what you actually do is you look at the bits that are overexposed and you take those from the darker image and you put those in their place. So they're actually using different brightness values. So it's like trying to make lots of information fit in a small hole again, but you intelligently say, I'll have this bit from you, this bit from you, and this bit from you on a pixel-by-pixel basis.
Okay.
So it's like a really intelligent version of the old trick where you take one for the sky and one for the ground and you use a layer in Photoshop and just mask one over the other.
Right, right.
But imagine doing that for every single pixel one by one with 3 images to choose from and taking each pixel from the best possible place.
Right.
Yeah, it's not interesting, right? But you need to do that to make any use of your HDR. And the tone mapping is the hard bit. Sticking the images together is easy, but the tone mapping is the hard bit. And that's where programs like Photomatics give you easily 50 sliders, and it's great if you know what you're doing. You can do fantastic stuff with it, but if you don't really know what you're doing, you're going to get horribly turned off and you'll have spent $100 on something that's really quite difficult.
Right, and you've reviewed that in the past.
I love that program. I use that program all the time, but it's not easy.
Okay, so you have an easier one.
HDR, now it's HDR TIST, which if you pronounce American, is HDRtist, or HDRtist, sorry, not HDRtist. And HDRtist gives you HDRtist, right?
It's actually HDRtist, is the way we would say it. Pound cultural differences. Anyway.
Yeah, definitely. On both the R and the H.
Right.
So this is a free program called HDRtist, or HDRtist, or whatever way you want to say it. Mm-hmm. And you drag and drop in either multiple JPEGs, and it will combine them for you, or a single TIFF, which you've gotten from a RAW file, or even just your RAW file. You just drag and drop in enough photos to have plenty of information for it to work with. and it has one slider. And that one slider basically says more or less tone mapping, please. Doesn't give you all the infinite amount of control over the tone mapping. It just says, move me left or right, and you'll see the result in real time, and then whenever you're happy, just let go.
This is about my attention span. You can add photos, you can remove them, and you can move a slider. You can save them.
Yes. The other nice thing about it is it'll even give you slight HD, slight tone mapping on just a single JPEG.
Yeah, I've been playing with it. That I haven't even tried giving it more than one photo because I haven't taken more than one photo of anything in a long time.
More than one photo really easily without much effort. If you use Aperture like I do,
right?
If you export a photo that's you took in RAW out of Aperture as a 16-bit TIFF,
okay,
that will actually have all the nice juicy HDR data in there, and you take that TIFF and drop that one TIFF into HDArtist, and away you go.
Ah, okay. By the way, that is one thing. HDArtist will allow you can say open photos and it'll look at your iPhoto library, but it will not look at your Aperture library.
Yeah, but then, to be honest, I would export out of Aperture anyway.
Okay.
So rather than throwing it an F file, I'd prefer to throw it a TIFF file. Okay. And if it's a 16-bit TIFF, you're not losing anything.
I have never done a 16-bit TIFF. I don't even know.
It's actually one of the standard exports.
There it is. Original size 16-bit TIFF. Okay, I'm playing with it while we're doing it, of course.
Now, don't panic. It will be a big file.
Right, right.
Because it's uncompressed everything that was in that RAW.
Yeah, let's see how big that
fast. 25 megs at least.
Let's see. 8.8 megs. Oh, but this wasn't... I'm sorry, that was not a RAW photo. Let me go find my own. I'll get one of my own. No, that was one of somebody else.
If you take a RAW from a D40, it's about 25 megs.
Yeah. Okay, I got to go get a real one. All right, keep going.
So literally, you just slide the slider over and back. And actually, one of the really nice things is it even makes a best guess where the slider should go.
That is so
fun. It doesn't always put the slider in the same place. It took me a while to cop onto this because I always thought I had so little work and it was kind of weird until I noticed that one photo would have put the slider almost all the way to the right and the other one would put it almost all the way to the left. But it actually turned out to always be really quite an intelligent choice.
Neat. It's really fun to play with. I don't know whether I'll ever use them for anything, but I've been doing a whole bunch of them. I'm going to put three in the show notes. I took a photograph that I actually did not take. But anyway, I did a before and after at a like medium level slider and the full on slider, and I'll put those in the show notes.
Cool. The other thing I should probably say is, you know, this thing has two massive advantages. It's trivially easy and it's free. And it's hard to understate those.
Right.
But the more you start to use it, you're going to start to notice HDR artifacts. Haloing is probably the most common thing you're going to start to see. Where buildings seem to have a funny halo around them and stuff like that.
Right.
The more of a perfectionist you become and the more you start to notice those halos and wish you could do something about them, the moment you get to that stage where you say, I wish I could tweak it so that I had all of this goodness but without those little side effects, when you get to that point, you're ready to spend the money on Topaz Adjust or Photomatix Pro.
Okay. But that's a good way to get started, right?
I think it's a fantastic way to get started. And you may well find that it's just not for you. It's not something you're interested in. Well, hey, you've saved yourself a lot of money to find that out using a free product instead of an expensive product.
Right. Right. What fun. Well, hey, I hate to cut us off. We have been having a lot of fun here, but Steve is about to be on Mac Tips Daily in about 5 minutes, Ooh. So I have to give up the interwebs to Jonathan Cost next.
Ooh, I look forward to that. I didn't know Jonathan was doing guest appearances on Mac Tips Daily.
Yeah, apparently he is. Well, you know, Steve's internationally famous and all that, so, you know, it's
oh, good point.
It's pretty, yeah, I mean, you know, if you could get Steve... Yeah, realize
that's
that,
true. Right? I mean, why would you have Steve Jobs? You can have Steve Sheridan.
Exactly, exactly. All right. Well, hey, this has been a lot of fun. It was a pretty filled episode. This is great. I learned a lot.
Good, good. I presume we're on for Normals next week?
I believe so. Unless otherwise... Excellent. Oh, wait a minute. Next weekend... next weekend is iPad Saturday. We may have to shift the time a little bit. We'll have to.
Do you want to go before the iPad goodness, or do you want to go after the iPad goodness
well,
and be all iPad obsessed?
It's well, I promise not to be iPad obsessed with you because of it not being.
Come on,
Ireland.
You get that distracted by HDArtist. How are you not going to be distracted by an iPad?
Oh, hang on, Bart. I'm playing over here. Yeah, that's gonna be tough. But the problem is, the store opens at 9 a.m.
Oh,
so I'll have to figure something out. We'll figure it out, though.
Yeah, well, there's 2 days in it. Is next weekend not Easter?
You're right, but I don't get a day off or anything.
Really?
No. Nope.
There's not even a public holiday on Easter Monday.
No, usually I think some people get Good Friday off, but that's about it.
I get both.
All right. Well, we'll talk soon.
We'll throw something out. Until then, happy computing.
Well, I have one correction to make. After I got off Skype with Bart and handed over the internet connection to Steve, he clarified something. The show that Steve was working on for Jonathan Cost is a new podcast series. He calls it Think Mac Reviews. It's over at thinkmac.net. Didn't want to mess you all up there. Well, with that out of the way, I'm going to bid you adieu. Until next week, iPad weekend, woohoo! You can email me at allison@podfeet.com. Send in your comments, questions, dumb questions especially. And don't forget to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. If you can find some free time on Sunday, be sure to join the live show over at 5 p.m. GMT-8 on Sunday nights. All you have to do is go to podfeet.com/live and jump in. It's terrific fun. It's a family-friendly environment. And the Nosilla Castaways will welcome you with open arms. In fact, this week we were joined by Tyson Brooks, Big Bad Fletch, Kentek, Ray in Arizona, and they were all welcomed in. Everybody liked having them there, so you guys should come in too. Anyway, that's going to close out the show. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.